Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Points of Attack by Mike Krentz, narrated by Kate Zane. Chapter 1. Scarlet. Navy Captain Kate Mahoney, call sign Scarlet, maneuvered the F-A-18 Super Hornet into the initial approach for landing. She leveled the wings to line up the nose precisely on the midline of runway 07. A quick glance out the cockpit to her 1 o'clock position took in the peaceful greenery over Mount Suribachi, the scene of a pivotal Pacific battle during World War II, when this island was called Iwo Jima. Kate squinted to glimpse the U.S. flag flying at the spot of the iconic flag-raising photograph taken on February 23, 1945. Showtime, Scarlet. Kate tightened her torso harness and latched the oxygen mask over her nose and mouth. Seconds later, her young nugget wingman lined up his Hornet alongside hers at a proper interval. The two jets descended as one, then screamed over the runway at 500 miles per hour. At the opposite end, Kate gave her wingman the standard kiss-off gesture to indicate her solo turn into the traffic pattern. She recited aloud the mantra she'd learned years ago in flight school. Flop! Kate jammed the stick hard to her left, rolling the aircraft into a 90-degree banked level turn 500 feet over the terrain. The immediate 9G force from the high-speed maneuver pressed her body into the ejection seat as the anti-G trousers compressed her legs to push blood to her head. Her vision tunneled from the abrupt reduction of blood flow. She growled the word, "Hook!" and strained against the darkness on the edge of her vision. Chop! Her left hand pulled the throttle back to reduce airspeed as her right hand eased the control stick to the right. The jet rolled out of its turn exactly 180 degrees to her original heading of 070. Kate popped out the speed brakes, eased further back on the throttle, and raised the aircraft's nose to maintain level flight parallel to the runway. Check. Kate monitored her airspeed as it continued to bleed off to the proper landing envelope. Drop. When the airspeed indicator showed the right number for safe gear deployment, she cycled the handles to drop the landing gear and tailhook into landing positions. Abeam her expected touchdown point, she nudged the throttle back and began a slow left-turning descent. Kate rolled the jet out of its turn to align the nose on the touchdown point, spotted the Fresnel lens meatball alongside the runway, noted her remaining fuel, and keyed her microphone to identify herself and report the jet's fuel state. Hornet 215, 6.8. The landing signal officer's voice answered over the radio.
Hornet 215, roger. Call the ball.
Roger, ball. Kate relished the familiar feel on the controls as she worked throttle and pitch to keep the meatball centered between the reference lines. The ball dropped a bit when the jet crossed the runway's edge. Kate eased the throttle forward just before the landing signal officer's verbal advice on the radio.
Little power.
In seconds, the ball rose. Kate touched the throttle to lose just enough airspeed to keep the ball centered. She let the Hornet float the last few feet into the arresting wires. As soon as she felt the wheels touch asphalt, she jammed the throttle forward to full military power for an immediate takeoff if the tailhook failed to grab a wire. The jet lurched to a sudden stop as the arresting gear yanked it back. Kate reduced the power to idle. When signaled clear of the wire, she raised the hook and expedited her taxi off the runway, just in time for her wingman to make his arrested landing behind her. As she taxied her jet to the ramp, Kate gave herself a fist pump. Yes! Early in her aviation career, Scarlet Mahoney often boasted she loved flying more than sex. Now in her early 40s, she'd gone so long without either that she couldn't vouch. She preferred actual control of an aircraft over flying a desk, no matter how important or career-enhancing the job. As for sex, Preston Davis remained eager to sponsor her re-entry. She'd not found the right occasion, or mood, in the 2 months since he'd surprised her by showing up on the pier from the U.S. with her teenager son, when USS Shenandoah returned to Yokosuka, Japan after a 4-month deployment. Kate had found flying easier, safer, and less daunting to resume. Scarlett reveled in full control of the world's most sophisticated and deadly carrier-borne fighter attack jet. With this landing, she had completed her successful requalification as a full-up round U.S. Navy Hornet jockey. She still had to execute the same proficiency landing on an actual aircraft carrier at sea, but her military mind harbored no doubt that she would succeed. Earlier in the month, Kate had difficulty convincing Vice Admiral Darnell Lewis, USN, Commander U.S. 7th Fleet, to allow her to fly at all, much less perform carrier landings.
"Why should I allow my chief of staff to risk her ass flying jets?"
The twinkle in the admiral's eye belied the sternness in his voice, so Kate rolled in at full throttle.
"You never know when you'll need me to lead a sortie. When national security is at high risk, you want your best fighter attack pilot leading that mission, don't you, sir?"
"You'll get enough sorties of another kind just keeping the staff and subordinate commanders in line, COS.
Lewis had smiled when he said that.
"Let the young fighter jocks take their turns at guts and glory."
"I understand my primary job as chief of staff, sir. I also understand there's not another pilot in the air wing with my record in actual combat. You know what I did over Iraq. I should keep my skills current, just in case."
When the admiral scowled, she changed tack.
"I will gain credibility. The staff and subordinate commanders will see me as a fellow warrior, not some privileged woman wearing the loop and manning the desk outside your office."
In the end, Lewis had relented, and Kate had relished every moment in the Hornet cockpit. In all her life, nothing had satisfied her inner soul more than flying, not even her son, or Colonel Preston Davis, United States Marine Corps, retired, Kate's would-be lover. Kate brought the Hornet to a stop on the ramp, shut down the engines, and completed the post-flight checklist. She pushed thoughts of Preston from her mind, climbed out of the aircraft, and headed to the squadron ready room for the debrief. She would spend the night on Iwo To. Tomorrow she would fly a Hornet back to its home base at Naval Air Facility Atsugi, Japan, on the outskirts of the Tokyo-Yokohama megaplex. Because the Atsugi NAF was in a densely populated area, the Navy conducted its field carrier landing practice at the remote Iwo To Japanese facility, both for noise abatement and to avoid the unpleasant, albeit minimal, risk of a jet crashing into the Japanese community surrounding the base. By seniority, Kate could have opted to fly home in the C-40 transport aircraft. The modified Boeing 737 had arrived that morning and would return to Atsugi the following day, filled with personnel and equipment as the air wing redeployed to its home base. Instead, she had cajoled the air wing commander to allow her to take the Hornet. Kate felt only a twinge of guilt about bumping one of the squadron junior pilots from that sortie. She'd made plenty of transit in the C-40. Scarlett Mahoney had paid her dues, and now reaped the benefit.
Chapter 2. Troy.
Where else in the world could a U.S. Navy lieutenant doctor fresh from family practice residency run his own low-volume, low-acuity medical practice in an exotic land far removed from meddling medical bureaucrats? Dr. Troy Pearson, Lieutenant, Medical Corps, United States Navy, relished his job as a medical officer in charge of the small clinic at the sleepy U.S. Navy station adjoining the vast Republic of Korea, ROK, Navy base, near the quaint town of Chinhae, South Korea. A short ride away, the sparkling resort city of Busan offered unfettered access to robust nightlife, a fabulous playground for a handsome, single American doctor. 6 months into his 1-year tour, Troy had already requested an extension of his orders for another 12 months. Cooled down and showered from his vigorous morning workout at the base gym, Troy swaggered through the front doors of his clinic. Mrs. Moon intercepted him. Fear distorted the South Korean clinic manager's usually placid face. Her voice quivered.
We need you right away in the main treatment room.
Without waiting for his reaction, she motioned him down the short hallway. Troy dumped his gym bag at the door and followed Mrs. Moon into the treatment room. A distraught mother, whom Troy recognized as one of the Navy spouses on base, clutched the hand of a child about 6 years old, lying still on a stretcher. Two hospital corpsmen fretted over the young patient. Troy did not need a wealth of medical training to see that the child was gravely ill. He spoke to the senior corpsman.
What?
The mother looked up, recognized him, and answered.
He's so weak, doctor. He couldn't swallow a glass of orange juice. Now he can't even sit up.
Troy glanced at the two corpsmen. Their distraught expressions mirrored those of Mrs. Moon and the mother. Troy steeled himself not to succumb to the aura of fear that permeated the room. He thought about his emergency department rotation while a resident at Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton, California. Take your own pulse first, the sage ED attending had counseled him. Troy took a breath, moved to the boy, and tried to engage him with a smile. No response. The child's eyelids drooped at half-mast. Troy used his thumbs to raise the lids to full open. The pupils pointed in different directions. Diplopia, Troy said. He inserted a wooden tongue blade into the boy's mouth. The child did not resist. The tongue and mucous membranes appeared dry. Troy touched the soft palate with the tip of his blade, stimulating a weak gag reflex. He looked at the mother.
Can he talk?
A little, but he sounds drunk.
Troy told the boy to squeeze his hand, but the child could not grip, only flexed his fingers. Troy moved each of his patient's arms and legs through normal range of motion, like trying to make a soggy, well-used rope stiff again.
Flaccid paralysis.
The mother gasped.
Paralyzed? He's paralyzed? It can't be polio. He's had all his shots.
Troy wished he could remember the woman's name. He touched her shoulder.
He's not paralyzed, but weak. Not polio. Could be several things. We can't do much for him here. We need to transfer him to a Korean hospital in Busan.
He worked at keeping his voice calm as he turned to Mrs. Moon. Call St. Mary's Medical Center and tell them we're transferring a child with ascending paralysis involving the brainstem of undetermined etiology. I'll talk to their physician myself. As Mrs. Moon scurried off, Troy addressed the younger of the two corpsmen, a female on her first assignment after completing hospital corps school.
Warm up the ambulance. I'll ride along with the patient.
As the young corpsman hurried out, he called to her,
First, bring in the crash cart, just in case.
The young lady stopped at the door, face ashen, eyes wide, mouth agape. Troy had not performed a major resuscitation since he took over the clinic. When did he last do so on a child? During his residency? He spoke to the corpsman in what he hoped was a calm but urgent voice.
Crash cart. Now, please.
Aye, sir.
She ran out of the room. Tuned in to the tension in the room, the mother hugged her son. Troy touched her arm.
I need to ask you some questions, Mrs.
Maddox. My husband is Lieutenant Commander George Maddox. This is Georgie.
I know your husband.
Most permanent personnel on the base knew each other. They lived in an American enclave in suburban South Korea, as close-knit as a small rural town in the USA. Troy kept one eye on Georgie while he talked to the mother.
When did this start?
2 days ago. He said he felt tired. We thought he was faking to get out of school.
She grimaced.
This morning he couldn't get out of bed.
Have you been anywhere unusual around Korea or elsewhere?
No, sir.
A pause.
Well, we went into town for dinner a few nights ago.
Where?
That Korean barbecue place on the main drag. We've been there many times.
Troy knew the restaurant, a frequentant of Americans from the Chinhe Navy base.
Anyone else sick at home?
No, sir.
The Corpsman appeared at the door without the crash cart. Her face had turned from ashen gray to pallid white.
Sir, we just got another patient, a girl with the same symptoms.
Alarms blared inside Troy's head. Two patients with bulbar palsy. Doubtful a coincidence.
Put her in the next room. I'll be right there.
As the new patient and her mother passed the main treatment room, the women recognized each other. The girl's mother stopped.
June, what are you doing here?
Georgie is sick, weak, can't get out of bed.
Oh, my God.
Melissa, same thing. She can't walk.
Troy intervened and addressed the newly arrived mom.
How old is Melissa?
6. She and Georgie are in first grade together. The alarms in Troy's head burst into full cacophony. He turned to the senior corpsman.
Get Melissa into a bed right away so I can examine her.
He addressed the other corpsman.
Monitor Georgie. Call me if anything changes.
It took only a minute to confirm Troy's suspicions. Melissa also had sign of brainstem dysfunction and advanced flaccid paralysis. He issued similar orders for her and asked Mrs. Moon to tell the Busan hospital to expect 2 transfer patients. As he returned to the main treatment room, the front door opened. Troy turned to see another distraught mother carrying a young boy in her arms.
First grader?
Troy asked. The mother nodded, confusion overtaking distress.
He can't walk.
Troy had no more treatment rooms, so he pointed to a chair in the waiting area.
I'll be right with you.
He went to the front desk and spoke to Mrs. Moon.
Call the base commander. Tell him I can't get away from my patients right now, but I need him to trust me. He must close the base school, now. No students or teachers should enter or leave that place until I figure out what's happening.
Troy started back to the mother and child in the waiting room.
Doctor!
The female corpsman's voice shrieked from the main treatment room.
Georgie, stop breathing!
Chapter 3. Kate. Debriefed, showered, and changed into a fresh flight suit, Kate headed to the Iwoto officer's mess for lunch. To her surprise, Captain Nick Jewell, the 7th Fleet Logistics Officer, N4, sat alone at one table. She set down her tray of food and took a seat facing him.
Did you ride a bike all the way from Japan?
Kate chuckled. Nick's passion for and prowess at bicycling had become legendary among the 7th Fleet staff.
Haven't figured out how to pedal on water yet, he said. But if I did, it's just under 700 miles from Yokosuka. Could ride that in less than a week.
What are you doing here? Admiral send you to spy on me?
That transparent?
He smiled.
Nah, I need to confer with our JASDF hosts about some logistics issues with the air wing coming out here again. So I hopped on the C-40.
He shook his head.
Waste of time. Their log guy doesn't speak English.
Kate set down her hamburger.
Don't they provide a translator?
Sure, but how do I know he's accurate?
Nick, we are close allies with the Japanese. You can trust them.
In war and politics, sure, but this is business. In business, I don't trust anyone, even those who wear the same uniform as I do. Number one rule of logistics and business, trust no one.
Kate snorted.
Do you trust me?
Of course. I've seen you drunk and almost naked, remember?
Kate blushed as she recalled how Nick and Eric Mickelson had rescued her in Manila when she'd over-imbibed while celebrating her first diplomatic victory with her Philippine Navy counterpart. She had forgotten to bring a replacement for the sweat-soaked sports bra she'd worn while playing golf. Nick had spared her the embarrassment of dining improperly attired with their Filipino hosts by finding a jacket to cover her braless torso under a sheer blouse. Later, he had gotten her back to the flagship when she was too drunk to navigate on her own. Kate owed Nick Jewell. She smiled.
Watashi wa Nihongo o hanashimasu.
Nick lit up.
Is there no end to your talents? Where did you learn to speak Japanese?
My major in college, William and Mary. He smiled.
I could use your help, COS.
Why did Nick address her with the acronym for Chief of Staff, the title of her official relationship with him? They were colleagues of the same rank, were they not? She would have preferred he use her first name. Kate spent most of the afternoon translating for Nick's conversation with his Japanese Air Defense Force, JASDF, counterpart. She had difficulty with some of the technical logistic terms, even in English. She got through those with Nick's tutelage. That evening, Kate met Nick for dinner, after which they went to the officers' club for drinks. Nick surveyed the limited offerings in the bar.
I see mostly blended scotch, not your preference.
Kate shared his disappointment. She had socialized with Nick only twice before, both times at staff events, yet he'd picked up on her preference for single malt scotch. Cute. Nick lit up in the same boyish way as earlier in the day when he learned of her Japanese proficiency.
Have you ever tried Suntory? Like most things in Japan, an imitation that improves on the original.
She shrugged.
When in Iwoto?
The Suntory surpassed Nick's promise. After her second drink, she felt more relaxed than she'd been since agreeing to take on the chief of staff job right after Shenandoah returned to Yokosuka from a difficult deployment 2 months earlier. She found Nick an engaging conversationalist, facile on many topics, and very witty. He had her laughing out loud with some of his embellished stories about his Navy adventures and bicycle treks over roads throughout the Western Pacific. I have a bike, Kate said, but I'm not an experienced cyclist. Back in the U.S., I would sometimes get out and ride as a break from running. I'm scared to try it in Japanese traffic.
Nick chuckled. I ride out in Yokosuka every morning, often to Yokohama or even Tokyo. I find Japanese drivers far more accommodating than Americans.
But the streets are so narrow and always crowded.
How often do you see a traffic accident in Japan?
I can't say I've ever seen one.
My exact point. They don't make driving a competition like Americans do. Even on the narrow streets, they respect your bike and they give you space.
I don't know if I could do it.
Tell you what, we have a small group that rides on Sunday mornings when we're in port. It's called the Club Ride because it's not aggressive or competitive. The group rides only as fast or as far as the least experienced cyclist.
He gave her a winning smile.
Join us. Might be fun. And wouldn't hurt staff morale to see the COS having some fun instead of grousing behind her desk all the time.
I grouse behind my desk?
Some folks consider you overly serious. He winked. They didn't see you in Manila.
She returned a demure smile.
Okay, I might take you up on it.
Nick's eyes glinted.
Sunday, then. Meanwhile, another drink?
Kate looked at her watch.
I'm flying tomorrow. Better not.
Nick shrugged.
Okay. Mind if I have one? You don't have to stick around if you need to get your crew rest.
Go ahead. I can hang out a while longer.
Roger.
Nick beckoned the bartender.
Suntory for me and sparkling water for the lady.
Kate raised her hand.
Make it 2 whiskeys. I'll let a nugget take my Hornet slot tomorrow. I can go on the C-40.
You sure?
Yeah, I can get some work done on the flight, so I won't be a Grinch behind my desk the rest of the day.
She winked. Nick grinned.
Deal.
Chapter 4. Troy.
Breathe, Georgie, breathe.
Troy gently squeezed the neoprene bag connected to the tube he had inserted into Georgie's trachea. Each squeeze delivered oxygen-enriched air into the boy's small lungs. The symmetrical rise and fall of both sides on Georgie's chest reassured Troy that he was achieving the desired effect. He looked at the senior corpsman.
How are the other kids? They seem stable, sir. We're ready to transport all three to St. Mary's. Traffic will be a mess, though.
Give it your best shot, HM2. We gotta get this kid on a ventilator now, and get the other two in a place where they can be resuscitated simultaneously if needed.
The junior corpsman stuck her head in the door. Ready to go on your command, sir.
Troy nodded. Check that IV to make sure it's still open. Try to get a blood pressure.
With his free hand, he reached up to wipe the sweat that had accumulated on his brow, despite the early morning chill in the clinic.
I get 60 pelp, the corpsman said.
Her grim expression mirrored what Troy assumed she saw on his own face.
Turn the IV wide open. But gotta worry about fluid overload. Kid doesn't need more volume. It's the flaccid legs, no tone.
Grab ace bandages and wrap the legs from toes to thigh, like mast trousers.
The corpsman's quizzical look reminded Troy that medical anti-shock trousers, a G-suit similar to those worn by jet aviators, had fallen out of use once proved ineffective in raising blood pressure in patients suffering from hemorrhagic shock. But this child was not low on blood volume. It had all pooled in his paralyzed legs. A compression bandage might return some of that blood to his heart and to his brain.
Just do it, please, Troy said. Nothing to lose here.
80/40,
the corpsman said after she'd gotten the ace wraps on and rechecked the blood pressure. She smiled at Troy as if he'd just pulled a bunny out of a hat.
Better,
he said, not ashamed to utter his own sigh of relief.
Low normal, but better.
Turn back the IV rate, titrate it to keep his vitals in that range.
Mrs. Moon appeared in the doorway. Doctor from St. Mary's on the line, and we have two more children in the waiting room, same symptoms.
Ask the doctor to wait a minute.
Troy addressed the two corpsmen, his voice as supportive as he could make it.
You got this. I have to stay here for these and any other patients. The ER team at St. Mary's will wait for you in the ambulance bay.
The two corpsmen looked grim.
Aye, sir,
the HM2 said.
Get moving,
Troy said.
Safely.
As soon as the ambulance left, Troy picked up the phone.
Dr. Pearson here.
Troy, my friend, what will you send us?
Troy recognized the voice of Dr. Duck Young Woo Bak, the Korean emergency physician with whom he shared patients, rounds of golf, and an occasional height beer.
Duck, my friend, we are sending you three children with similar symptoms of bulbar palsy and flaccid paralysis, undetermined etiology. I'm thinking Guillain-Barré syndrome. The most critical, Georgie Maddox, quit breathing, but we got him intubated and ventilated right away. Vital signs improving, so hopefully no brain damage.
Any others? Troy's stomach nodded.
Yes, two more waiting to be seen. All the same age, same school, same class.
His friend remained silent, but his breathing picked up. When Duck spoke, his voice sounded ominous.
We have six Korean children here, two on ventilators, all same, flaccid paralysis and bulbar palsy.
Ages? Troy asked.
8, Duck said. All from the same school near our ROK Navy base in Busan.
Holy crap, Troy said.
His own breathing quickened.
I have to make some calls. Please let me know when our patients arrive there.
Of course.
Troy hung up and punched a speed dial. Commander Roger Thornton, the U.S. Navy base commander in Chinhae, answered on the second ring.
Commander, Troy said, we need to shut down the base. Whatever made our kids sick also struck the ROK Navy base in Busan. We should contact USFK and 7th Fleet ASAP.
Chapter 5. Kate. The next afternoon, Kate suffered a slight boiling in her stomach as their car from the Atsugi Naval Air Facility returned to the U.S. Naval Base in Yokosuka. She and Nick had stopped for lunch during the one-hour ride. The mild gastric upset seemed to Kate a small price to pay for the delight of Yokosuka Navy curry, a local favorite. Introduced by the British to the mess kitchens of the Japanese Navy around the turn of the century, the spicy dish had been perfected over the years. It remained a traditional staple on board the ships of the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, JMSDF, the U.S. Navy's ally that shared the Yokosuka Natural Harbor named Truman Bay.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?